Accession number 28361, Reel 9.
General Julian Thompson, Reel 9.
Where was 42 Commando when you joined them? And
42 Commando was at Bickley, which is just on the outskirts of Plymouth, on the edge of Dartmoor. And the commando was in cadre form, and this was a money-saving device at the time, in that it was at about half strength and formed the administrative support for the commando corps. So you had half a commando sitting at Bickley, which was operational and would be brought up to strength in time of war, and then go off to do its job. And the other half was the commando training wing, consisting of instructors and students doing the commando course. And in fact, the commando had actually been brought up to strength twice in the time it was in that form, once for Suez in 1956 and once in 1958 for the what we called in those days the Lebanon crisis, which was the uprisings of, in many Arab countries around the Mediterranean. For example, it was the one in which Faisal in Iraq was assassinated, and there was a threat to King Idris of Libya. So twice it was brought up to full strength. And after the second time, it then remained at full strength and rejoined the commando brigade and left Bickley. So that's a quick sort of resume of what 42 Commando was about at the time that I was serving with them.
And you arrived before the occasions when it was made up to full strength?
Yes, I arrived after Suez, which yes. I missed because I was yes. doing my machine gun course to my fury. So they, by that time, had return to being cadre plus training, and I wasn't with them when they were brought up to strength again in 1958, because by that time I'd joined another commando in the Mediterranean.
So you missed out on all the excitement.
Well, I got the excitement the second time because I was actually in the Mediterranean for the Lebanon crisis. Yes. With another commando.
Do you remember members of the commando telling you anything about Sirius when you joined them in 57?
They did. They were full of it, and you know, it was rather irritating to hear them going on about it. And in the Royal Marine language, swinging the lamp is the Royal Marine slang for it. Yes, and many of them were still in the commando and hadn't gone off to do other things, and so one was getting the sort of worm's eye view of what the Suez operation was about from people who'd been on the ground, and it was actually quite interesting. Of course, one was getting the snapshots of what they were up to. And the commando actually landed in LVTs, Second World War vintage Buffaloes, armoured swimming vehicles. And one of the stories, I mean, this doesn't affect, it wasn't my story, but as you were asking about it, is that they'd done so many rehearsals that the Buffalo crews thought that the real thing was going to be another rehearsal and had failed to bolt on the armour which they were meant to put on the sides of these vehicles. And the first .5 round that was fired at the leading Buffalo went straight through and out the other side, to everyone's surprise.
Must have been rather alarming for the men inside.
Yes, it was. So they say. I mean, as I say, I wasn't there. They were telling me about it.
These are the Buffalo is the sort of vehicle that we used, I think, Northwest Europe in 44, 45 with tracks.
Yes, they were the American vehicles. The they were not in at Normandy, and my goodness me, they'd have made a lot of difference if we'd had them for Normandy. The first operation they were used in was at Walcheren in November 44, and of course they were used again for the Rhine crossing in March 45, and then disappeared out of the inventory.
And do you remember them telling you of any particular lessons they thought they'd learned from the Suez operation when they were discussing it?
I don't remember any particular lessons. Of course, it was all street fighting and use of armour because the 6th RTR was supporting the commando brigade. So each commando, I think, had a squadron of armour attached to it. And they'd done a lot of very good rehearsals in derelict buildings in barracks in Malta, because they knew they were going to have to fight in the streets. So they were very well trained for what they had to do, and they had plenty of time to prepare, because the Suez Crisis sort of ground on and on and on and on. I know the 42 Commando, who I talked about earlier, I think they went out to the Med in about July or August of 1956, and the landing didn't take place until the beginning of November, so they had about 3 months in which to train and prepare for the operation.
Do you remember if any of them commented at all on the quality of the opposition, of the street fighters they were up against?
They said that the opposition wasn't all that good, and I didn't think it was, actually.
What were you doing then day to day when you were with the commando and it was in Carter form? What was the
well, I was an instructor running the commando course for recruits, and so I had my own squad of recruits, which I was in charge of, and I had about four senior NCOs and in fact and a corporal to help me instruct them, and I ran the training according to a program which I was given. So that on a particular day I'd be speed marching, or another day I'd be taking them on the scramble course, another day I'd be taking on an exercise on Dartmoor, and the program was given to me, so I knew exactly what I was going to have to do any day in the week for the 6 week course. Is this going to bother you, this scratching sound in the background? And I found it great fun, actually, because you were in charge of these chaps, and I wasn't much older than they were, and they were, I had regulars and national servicemen at the time I was there, because I went in January 57 and I left in about November 57, and in that 10 months I suppose I must have taken about four or five squads through, and they were regulars squads and national service squads.
Was there any difference between them?
No, the regulars had done far more training. They'd done 12 weeks at the depot deal, followed by 12 weeks at the what was called the infantry training centre at Limpston, and then they came to us, and so they'd done more training. So they were in a way more stereotyped. The national servicemen had done less training, but they were full of enthusiasm. Excellent chaps, and of course I don't know whether I said this before, but the Royal Marines only had about a third national servicemen, whereas the Army had rather more. And to be a national serviceman in the Royal Marines, you actually had to want to do it. You had to commit yourself to being in the Royal Marine Reserve probably before you joined, and certainly after you'd finished your time. And so though I'm not suggesting that national servicemen would have joined had there not been conscription, we effectively had volunteers.
Volunteer conscripts.
Volunteer conscripts, because they had to be conscripts, but they wanted to join the Royal Marines and do commando training, and they had to commit themselves to something rather more than just their time of service in order to do that.
How long would that reserve commitment last?
It would not. It was not set in concrete. It was all a bit
indeterminate.
So the chap, if he wanted to join the Royal Marines as a National Serviceman, to show commitment and get selected, he would probably join the Royal Marine Reserve. So he could then form up and say, look, I'm a Royal Marine Reservist, I really do want to do my National Service in the Royal Marines, okay, we'll take you. Then afterwards, he would probably do 2 or 3 years, depending on what his job was. And it wasn't, he wasn't held to it, but he demonstrated commitment, and so he was someone one wanted to have.
Did those reservists, while they were on reserve, do refresher training at any stage?
Well, the RMI, they belonged to the Royal Marine Reserve. They were not reservists in the sense that they were reservists like people who have a reserve commitment, as in the old days when you joined for what was known as 7 and 5, where you had 7 years with the colours and 5 years with the reserve. They were with the RMR, and of course their training depended on them turning up on drill nights and camps and so on. And that's why I'm saying it wasn't a reserve commitment in the sense that you could go and pull them out and say, off you go to place X. It was merely a demonstration of their commitment in order that they could join the Royal Marines as a national servicemen.
And then afterwards they carry on with the same thing, going to drill nights and...
Yes.
So it sounds as though the Marines were relying more on the voluntary principle than the army.
Yes, they were. I mean, they were conscripts. As I said before, they probably wouldn't have joined anything had there not been conscription. But they chose to join the Royal Marines rather than anybody else. And therefore, I think they had the sort of volunteer attitude towards life.
How many of them would you have in a squad?
A squad would vary depending on the size of the intake, but it would be around 30 to 40 chaps, I suppose.
And what sort of attrition rate did you have during these training?
Actually, we had quite a low attrition rate. It always surprises me when I now think of the very high attrition rate on the commando course, which is something like 30%, yes. And has been 30% for years and years and years. Mm-hmm. The attrition rate was quite low, and I put this down to the fact that the two things, I think. One, most of them played sport at their schools, whether they went to fee-paying schools or the majority of course them went to state schools. They played sport. A lot of them in those days did jobs that were physical. They were, you know, brickies or builders' mates or miners. A lot of miners worked as farm labourers on road gangs and railway. And so they were physically, I think, stronger than the young man that you get joining now. And so, therefore, you had fewer injuries caused by the actual training. And I think the other thing was that we didn't pick up injuries in the way that we do now. So a chap would sort of limp on and get through and expect to ache all over and then sort of get better as he went on. Whereas now we're so conscious of injuries that we sort of put the chap under an x-ray machine and find he's got a hairline fracture or whatever it is, which in those days they didn't bother with or something. It's very difficult to determine why we had such a low dropout rate.
Do you think that they were physically harder and they were more inured to the idea of a certain amount of physical discomfort and suffering as part of life in general, apart from...
Yes, they were. I mean, we're talking about young men, this is the mid-50s, they'd been brought up in quite hard circumstances, some of them, and rationing, food rationing. They had quite tough lives, some of them, and so they didn't regard sort of hard training, I don't think, as being particularly exceptional. They just regarded it as what they expected.
What was the discipline like?
Discipline was quite tough, and certainly I don't remember having any sort of bad disciplinary cases. There was quite a lot of... if the squad was late for something, then there was sort of a punishment by me, which usually involved, you know, run to the top of that tor and back 5 times and do 50 press-ups and sort of physical type admonishment, if you like. A lot of unofficial punishment. I mean, not beating people up or bullying, but sort of, if you're late, then you're going to have to pay for it by doing something physical in response.
And how did they take to that? Did they accept it?
They accepted it. I've never had anyone coming to me to complain. I mean, it was accepted with a sort of cheerful, you know, hard luck, we've been caught, whatever it is.
What about your NCOs? How did they deal with fractures or...
In the same way. I mean, I don't remember many of my chaps being on a formal charge. They were keen to pass the course and get on with it. And the NCO would treat them in exactly the same way. You know, you're late over there and do 50 press-ups or whatever it was. And the NCOs themselves were pretty fit. I don't think any of the NCOs that I had been in the Second World War. By then, we're now 12 years after the end of the Second World War. But they'd served in Korea and Malaya, and they'd sort of knocked around, and some of them, of course, had served in Suez and just come back from there. So they were quite experienced chaps.
Did you find that the squads were roughly about the same level? Was there a consistency in the intakes, or did you find that some were notably better adapted to the training than others? Did it sort of go up and down?
I found that because the training was set to a pattern, so the people who were the product you were getting had gone through a standard form of training, they were more or less the same. And going back to business of punishment, it just reminds me, sometimes a squad would come to you with a bad name of being thoroughly, you know, they were always late, scruffy, idle, etc., 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 and sometimes with a string of punishments that they brought with them from the commando training centre. In other words, you know, they were chaps who still had days of what was in those days, you know, CB, confined to barracks, left. And I always used to line them up and say, right, you're now with a clean sheet. I don't care what you did in the past. Any punishments that you have or carrying with you are hereby cancelled. So as far as I'm concerned, you start with a clean sheet, and I'm only interested in how you perform here. I'm not interested in your past. And I found that actually worked quite well. You could see them sort of lift on they went, you know.
Well, it's always good to have the chance to turn over a new leaf.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely.
Was the discipline formal at all?
Oh, yes. It was formal in the sense that they saluted you, they stood to attention when they were talking to you, and there was formal discipline to the sense that if people were, you know, absent or drunk or chargeable in the sense that they'd committed some crime that was in the book, then they would be on a charge in front of the company commander or the CEO. But I don't remember many of them. I don't remember a great string of them. I mean, there must have been probably less than the fingers of my hand over a period of 9 months.
Well, that's partly, isn't it? Because as you say, they were partly self-selecting.
Yes.
So they would have a stake in remaining on good terms with the organisation.
Absolutely. Mm. I mean, the regulars, of course, were genuine volunteers because they'd volunteered to sign on for 12 years, or 7 and 5.
You got a training programme. How much scope did you have for variations within the parameters of the training programme so that you could introduce your own ideas?
Not a great deal, because most of the stuff was physical in the sense that you were taking them over the assault course or a thing called the scramble course or speed marches or physical tests. The only time when you had scope to introduce your own ideas is when you were taking them on exercises on Dartmoor, where you were doing very, very low level stuff. I mean, patrols and raids and section work and occasionally up to platoon level with field firing, which of course by its nature, because it was field firing, the safety regulations demanded that you had to do it in a particular way. So other than that, your program was set and you were going to do this on that day and you were required to get to that standard by the end of the day.
And did the company commander keep a close eye on you, or was he keeping on a loose rein? Did you find him looking over your shoulder off?
I mean, the chap I had was a wonderful chap called Roy Sillitoe, who had been in the Second World War, actually. Had been a commander in the Second World War. He'd gone through Acne Carry. He was very fit. I don't know how old he was. He seemed quite old to me, but I suppose he was in his mid-30s. But he'd come out on speed marches sometimes with us. And join in the exercises, but on the whole, he left you alone, and backed you up if something hadn't gone terribly right.
Did that happen from time to time?
Well, I remember one particular occasion when I had a run-in with the chap who ran the cliff climbing exercise, because one of the fun things we did at the end of the course, we did a week of raiding training and climbing training. using craft to land us at the foot of cliffs, which we would then climb up fixed ropes that have been fixed by climbers who've gone ahead, because we weren't teaching them to be climbers in the sense they were going to do free climbing of cliffs. And the last raid, or the last exercise, was a night climb and raid onto an objective, and then a withdrawal back down this cliff. And I decided to sort of pep it up a bit with thunder flashes and things like that. The chap who was running the climbing wing got slightly hacked off of the way I was doing it, and was bellowing at me in front of the troop. And so I went to see my company commander the next day and said, this chap had been interfering with my exercise, and so he had him in and tore him off a strip.
What was his objection? He just didn't like the banging.
He didn't like the sort of slightly cowboy bit that I introduced into the thing at the top of the cliff. But I said to my company commander, the whole point of climbing the cliff was to do a raid, not to just climb up it and go down again.
And this guy was here, an officer or an NCO?
He was an officer.
Yeah,
he was a captain. He was senior to me.
Oh, was he?
Oh, yeah.
And what was his? Did he see this being as being primarily sort of technical skills?
He was worried about safety, I think, that people would get put off by thunder flashes whizzing around their ears as they were trying to get down a cliff and might fall off. And perhaps he was right, but my company commander supported me.
Did any of your fellows fall off?
No.
They didn't?
No.
Mm-hmm. So you were doing that not for very long, actually. It's less than a year, isn't
it? Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Was this a short posting for any particular reason?
I'm not sure why it was so short, but I think one of the reasons it was short was that I said I'd quite like to go out to a commando abroad. I didn't want a soldier in England, and so my wish was granted. Mm-hmm.
So where did you go next?
I then went to 40 Commando, back to having been in 40 Commando, the first commando I was ever in.
Yes.
In the Canal Zone. And I then joined 40 Commando, and they were actually training in Libya, back in Tarhuna. Which is where I'd been a couple of years before. And by that time, of course, I was then posted to them as the machine gun platoon commander.
What was in the machine gun platoon?
Well, the machine gun platoon in the commando had four Vickers machine guns. There were two sections, two guns per section. And you had, I had a platoon sergeant, and each section was commanded by a sergeant. And then I had a number of vehicles each gun had a vehicle. A jeep and trailer, or a Land Rover and trailer. In fact, we had Champs, which you probably may remember, the Champ.
The Austin Champ,
which was not a great success, except it was rather fun to drive in the desert because it had independent suspension on all four wheels. You could drive it very fast across rough country. The machine gun, it was great fun. It was a good command because it was very much an independent command, and you made it. Its success depended on how well you handled it and trained them, and so on. And also, we were used in those days. There were no recce platoons or recce troops; they didn't exist on the establishment. But we were used as a recce troop. That's what my CO wanted me to do. And so, in the desert, we'd be going ahead of the commando, bearing in mind that a lot of the time you'd be in vehicles in order to cover that. The commando sort of was in the desert, was like a lorried infantry battalion, because there was no point in being on your feet because you couldn't get anywhere fast enough. And so I was like the present day recce troop or recce platoon out in front, giving warning of enemy and finding the way.
Was the idea that the machine gun section would be particularly good at that because it had better firepower if it should happen to encounter the enemy first?
Yes, the machine guns were mounted on the vehicles, and the idea was that it would be able to get itself out of trouble. I mean, it was actually a slightly bogus tactically, because being a soft-skinned vehicle, if you run into armour or even armoured cars, you'd have a hell of a hard time getting yourself out of it. But in those days, there was nothing better. I mean, nowadays you'd have specialist vehicles with some armour on them, perhaps, or the sort of vehicles you see being used, or one saw being used in the Iraq War. But we didn't have that sort of stuff.
Well, one still sees people charging around in modified jeeps with machine guns mounted on crossbars.
Sure. Well, we had the Vickers. In fact, it was mounted in the back of the vehicle. So in order to fire, you had to turn the vehicle round.
Very useful in retreat, though.
Very useful in retreat, exactly. But the fun thing was that one had to learn desert navigation. So yes. we had sun compasses and again, one was on one's own. Doing one's own thing, which was fun.
Now, quite often in infantry battalions in the army, they use their snipers as a sort of reconnaissance element.
Yes.
Was there ever any thought of doing that sort of thing?
No, we had snipers, but they were actually in those days part of the intelligence section. I don't know why, but I suppose because the IA was meant to deploy them. And we had, I can't remember how many snipers there were, because I wasn't involved with them, but I think it was something like half a dozen snipers. But, of course, playing at lorried infantry, as we were, in this very rolling desert, you needed to be vehicle-borne to cover the ground, because we used to exercise quite 200 or 300 or more miles south into the Libyan desert. And it was fascinating, because the maps were appalling, and one was seeing bits of country, huge wadis and sand dunes and even the edges of some of the sort of mountains that are in the Sahara in that region.
What were these maps? Were these old Italian maps, or were they British maps?
I think they were maps which had been copied from the Italians, and I think they were maps that were made by 8th Army, produced for 8th Army for the desert campaign. And as one got further and further south, the maps got worse and worse, I suppose, because the 8th Army didn't want to go particularly, didn't have to go all that far, they didn't certainly go as far south as we did. What was also interesting there was we came across minefields, which had been laid by either side during the war. And some of them weren't marked. I remember one particular occasion when we wandered into an anti-tank minefield and sort of tiptoed out again.
Did you have chaps who were trained in mine looking?
Yes. Our assault engineers, the equivalent of an assault pioneer platoon in an army battalion, were trained in that, yes. In fact, I remember eating my breakfast, watching my chum, who commanded the battalion, commanded the assault engineers, defusing an Italian anti-tank mine, which he'd lifted.
Were these mines still in working condition, do you think?
Oh, yes. Yes. I mean, we were just lucky we hadn't gone into a mixed minefield. It was an anti-tank minefield.
Well, there was always a principle that the Axis troops employed to try and separate tanks from infantry.
Yes.
So a mixed minefield is a pure barrier, but an anti-tank minefield means the infantry have to either stop or go on their own.
Sure. Well, I imagine that's what we hit. But there were huge areas which were mined.
Were you acting with armour? Because usually lorried infantry are employed in conjunction with armoured forces.
We did one exercise with armour, but the training period in Libya in those days was about 2 months you went for, and you were actually going through the traditional cycle of training, so that for the first week, the rifle troops would be doing section attacks and that sort of thing, and I'd be doing basic machine gunnery because on the field firing ranges, and then we'd all be doing our own individual training to bring us up to what ended up in the last 2 weeks of collective training for the whole commando, doing exercises which the CO had written, and sometimes we do brigade training, but this particular time that I was there, the whole brigade wasn't there. It was just 40 commandos, so the highest level we could attain was training at commando battalion level.
Was the exercise designed to assume that you were operating as part of the larger formation?
Yes. I mean, the sort of picture was we were part of something bigger, and as far as I remember on that particular period, we didn't.